Welcome to Education Scholars Conversations. I'm your host, Jeff Yan. In this episode, you will hear part two of my conversation with JT Torres, Director of the Center for Teaching and Learning, Quinnipiac University. More links and information about today's conversation can be found on Education's Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Full episodes of Education Scholars Conversations can be found on YouTube or your favorite podcast app. You know, we already talked about sort of a lot of mainstream, sort of views of higher education today, and some of it's not in a positive way, because some, I think that we can probably agree that, cost is definitely an issue. Affordability, of course, and to be inclusive, that's a whole other, thing to throw into the mix of factors. But I do want to talk about the product, the experience of higher education itself. You talked about first year experience, which you love. I love it too. But someone who's eager to become, X, whatever it is, a nurse, an engineer, or whatever, right? I've seen people who are like either themselves or their parents, being frustrated that, can I just go take that computer science class? Can I just go write code today? Or if I'm a nurse, can I just learn how to, perform some procedures with a patient? Or, give me some hard biology here, mm-hmm. right? Why am I taking this class that sets, ecological studies of food and agriculture and society? Mm-hmm. Like, why am I going to have to do that if I'm going to become a nurse? I feel like I have some good answers, but I think yours is going to be better. So,
I don't know, because as I'm hearing you articulate that, and we run into that a lot here. So, when I say here again, a professional university means that the way we market and the way we recruit students means that we're promising them fast tracks to the professions that they want, to the salaries that they want, the careers that they want. Okay. We get a lot of students who ask those questions, right? Like, why do I have to do a general ed curriculum? Mm-hmm. Why do I have to think critically? Why do I have to, be in these courses, right? That's frequent here, especially because of the university mission. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I have a lot of empathy for those students asking those questions. I think our curriculum needs a lot of revision. I don't just mean Quinnipiac, higher education in general. Mm. And I think there's a lot of limitations because of accreditation, right? We're just used to doing things in certain ways. We're used to assessing what we're doing in certain ways. And I don't think curriculum reform or even transformation has kept up with the changing landscape. So I have empathy for those students. I think that they've been messaged throughout their entire lives to get your salary as fast as you can, get your career as fast as you can. So we can't blame them for asking those questions. What we have to do in the meantime is remind them why those topics are important. This goes back to the just-in-case versus just-in-time learning, right? We cannot keep doing the just-in-case education because it's too expensive, right? I also have that point of empathy because tuition is so expensive. If I'm coming to school to be a nurse and I don't know, that I can benefit from having a much broader interdisciplinary perspective, if no one's ever explained that to me and I'm paying $70,000 to $100,000, depending on the university that I go to be a nurse, I want that to be as cheap as possible. And I don't want to incur those debts. So I am going to ask those questions. Why am I here? Right. And I think that's totally legitimate. What we have to do is go back to that just-in-time education. Right. So when I have students, I'll just speak to my experience. I've had students ask why they do need to take a first-year writing class or why they're taking an ecological literacy class. The class isn't called that, but why are they going to sit in a semester where they're reading about food and agriculture? I have to start right away with the student experience. What do you eat? Right? What do you care about eating? Have you known anybody who's had foodborne illness? Right? Start with this place of desire. Start with this place of connection. One thing that I've done is I've tried to jump out ahead of that question. So we have a pretty robust School of Health Science. We have lots of nursing students here, lots of OT, occupational therapy students. So I get a lot of School of Health Science students, and they come in with those same prerogatives where they just want to know, when do I get to be a nurse, right? When do I get certified? And so I don't rack up all these student loans. First day of class, I ask them, I make it an icebreaker, community building activity where I say, you know, some of you are nurses, some of you are engineers, but we're going to read about the environment this semester. As an introduction about yourself, can you tell me how you think your future career connects with the environment? Right. And then they come out just because I prompted them and I made it an environment where it's conversational. I'm not lecturing. I'm just asking. Here's a thought experiment. What do you think the connections are? And I'll regularly hear from students, the nursing students, who will say something like, hospitals create an enormous amount of waste. Here's an article I found that talks about the environmental waste of pharmaceuticals, of single-use protective equipment. Right. And then they come out and they start saying like, oh, wow, there's an environmental impact here. My large goal for everybody is to just realize everything is connected. My favorite movie is Everything Everywhere All at Once. All right, and so I want to create that, but in a classroom. I just want people to see that all the multiple universes that are out there connect in some way. And if you're open to that, if you realize that there's no such thing as an individual course, as an individual human or individual profession, if every decision we make has an impact on someone else, not only are we more likely to have empathy and inclusivity, but we're also understanding how this course connects with this course.
I think that's lovely. And I, by the way, I also agree with you. I want to go back a little bit on that. You had mentioned about, you know, we do need a reform in higher education. It's really far from perfect. And a part of it is, you know, like you were saying, how we assess them and accreditation. Maybe for those who don't understand all of the relationships, what does that mean? Like, what's accreditation? What has assessment got to do with it? And why is it so broken? Like, if we, you know, JT just said it. Like it's
don't get me in trouble. I didn't say that. I'm just joking.
This is a part that, you know, is bottlenecking us from.
Yeah, it is a bottleneck.
Being able to make big strides into an improved version of it that I think many of us could see and would like to see, and is worth a lot of money. Is a lot of resource. You know, they say it can save a lot of time. It can make all those students who are asking those questions, they will provide an answer to them. So why are we doing it? Like, what's the hold up?
Yeah, no, really great question. And it also relates back to our earlier conversation about the declining trust in higher education. Cool. Accreditation serves to make sure that we are doing what we say we are doing, right? It is a very, very important mechanism, right? It's quality control. It makes sure that when you go to one university and you accumulate a certain amount of credits in pursuit of a major, those credits should have the same value as a different university that you go to, regardless of prestige and name, right? It's just making sure that we are delivering what we say that we are delivering to the community. Reform is very, very difficult because there's declining trust in higher education as it is. And I don't know that it's necessarily a broken system. It's just a system that worked for a different time. I don't think the system has caught up with the changing landscape. And it's changing so fast that we're all kind of confused about how we go about changing. And that landscape has to do with, you know, falling attendance, falling enrollments, with increasing tuition, with AI, with the pandemic, you know, all these factors have dramatically changed the landscape. And so accreditation bodies and agencies are probably not keen on a whole new transformation right now when everybody feels that the land underneath us is very unstable. And so we need to find a way to maintain trust. A quick example is, you know, I love using e-portfolios because I believe in holistic assessment, right? The power of an e-portfolio, again, you're making learning visible, but you also get to tell the story of your own learning, of your journey. You get to see it happen. You get to include the data that's relevant to you, and you get to reflect back on what you're doing. That's really difficult to share across massive bodies of stakeholders, right? Institutions to it's so much easier for us to share grades, for instance. So I love e-portfolios, especially in the context of the ungrading movement. I work with a lot of educators, K-12 or in college, who want to find ways to ungrade their classes. And I am philosophically behind the concept of ungrading, right? I understand that grades are an institutional communication mechanism. It's just easier for us to say who somebody is in terms of a GPA than it is to say, look at this brilliant e-portfolio they have, right? Like, we just don't have enough people in the room to go in that direction. So while I'm philosophically behind on grading, I also reflect on if colleges and universities, like imagine tomorrow if all the universities said, we're going to get rid of grades because we want to be more equitable. My heart would be jumping up and down, but I have to imagine from the public perception, it's going to look like, so then you're a degree mill? How are you evaluating students, right? Like, where's the quality control? And then I imagine accreditation bodies, right, are going to freak out in terms of like, how do we know that what you're submitting as artifacts, right? And artifacts could be anything from a student essay to a paper to a project to exam scores. How do we know that these artifacts are aligned with a certain level of rigor that we expect from higher education? So I think that even when our heart is behind the changes that we need to make, the current social and cultural context around higher education is making it not, I'm trying to avoid using the word difficult because I don't think it's necessarily about difficulty. I think it's more about retaining and restoring public trust that we are rigorous, that we are holding people to high expectations. And then how can we do that in ways that's more meaningful?
Right, because we don't want the very mechanism that we designed to make sure that the checks and balances are in place to stop it from actually catching up with, you know, what to actually make it make to deliver the actual product that it's supposed to do, right?
Yep, exactly.
Because it's sort of in some ways, like you said, it hasn't caught up fast enough, and that as a result, it happens in a lot of things that are regulated, right? In the world. I think AI is actually a really big, you know, part of it. We're not able to, you know, legislate nearly fast enough, you know, comparing to how fast the technology is moving.
Yep.
And so that, you know, like, and it's not only cat and mouse, because it implies that you can eventually catch them. But it's more like a runaway train, you know? Like,
yeah, yeah.
So I think it is hard, and I do, you know, for me, I worry a little bit about sort of there is that public trust, but there's also just we have a lot of choices today, right? People can get some micro credentials in something. They could learn how to go. They can go if they want to learn something, they can take an online course of some sort, and that might be all that they needed. They actually didn't really want all this 4 years worth of it. Mm-hmm. And with all of the choices, it really does imply that, you know, the landscape of learning could just be really different.
Yes.
And the landscape of learning with credentials is also another sort of weird part too, because then accreditation comes with the credentialing part of it. And, and I will say that, I don't know, as someone who's maybe on the hiring side of you know, where we hire people at our company, you know, we look these days a lot less at their degree and where they came from. We look a lot more than the work that they're able to produce, and the kind of quality of the work, the quality of the personality, the cultural fit. And we are sometimes looking at that, you know, degree, not even as a requirement. It's just, okay, it's interesting that you went there and did this, and that it explains your trajectory of how things worked out. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah.
If you did that, you must know this, at least in my field, right? In, you know, hiring programmers, or, you know, even a customer support person, or, you know, like, I'm sure it's a little bit different if you're hiring, you know, like you said, a nurse. You know, I probably want someone who actually were vouched for, that they know how to perform these medical procedures safely, right? Mm-hmm. But for a lot of other fields, actually, you know, we're not looking at that as a requirement, really.
Right. It's less about like what badges you've earned in your scout sash, and more about like what are you able to do with that information.
Right. I really want to see you tie the knot. I don't want to see the fact is, you can tie knots, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean about authentic assessment, right? Like, and so working with faculty in my center, it's all about you know, let's just stay with the example of tying knots. If tying knots is the thing that will make you a professional in a particular field, then why don't you just assess them on tying knots? Don't just give them an exam about what a knot is, right? Yeah. And so that's where that movement, that's where I'm always trying to push the movement of assessment, the culture of assessment, into these authentic simulated spaces. And then back to that challenge of accreditation. How do we report that competency or that ability or that outcome? How do we communicate that and report that within our institutions and to other institutions, like an accrediting body, to show that, yeah, there's growth and we're doing what we say that we're doing. We're just using these authentic forms of assessment so students can do, rather than just credentialing them.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit about AI.
Yeah. Yeah.
We already mentioned it a few times. I think that these days you can't have conversations without talking about it somehow.
Or talking to it somehow.
Yeah, right. I think we should talk a little bit about it. I want to first point out one thing. I hopefully we don't stay on this for too long, but a lot of institutions, when they hear AI, they are still today, sort of plagiarism and, you know, academic honesty and cheating is the sort of the first thing, mm-hmm. you know, that many people are, you know, if we mention AI, that's going to be one of the top three things.
Mm-hmm.
And in most people, it's the top one thing. So what's going on there? Can you tell us?
I'll try my best. I can't, I don't know exactly what's going on, but you know, first thing, plagiarism is older than AI, right? Like we know that, yeah. that this has been a concern for many years, for everybody. And this goes back to our relationship with assessment that's more about accountability than it is about improvement, right? And it's not, we haven't been so concerned with, let me assess where you are, low stakes, so I can see where you are, so I can help you improve wherever you are, right? It's always been, let me assess where you are, because this assessment is going to have implications for your financial aid, for your scholarship, for your career, for your ability to say it. Like, we just create all these pressures that we inadvertently message to students, you better pass regardless of how you pass, right? Like, you want to keep your financial aid, you better pass this class, right? So we create all these external factors that AI is not really one of them. I don't think AI actually motivates cheating. And I know this is my own opinion anecdotally, but it's also based on the research, very new emerging research into AI use or even outsourcing assignments, right? Like, one of the most popular ways that students have plagiarized before AI is to go onto websites where you can pay somebody else to do the work for you, right? So it's not necessarily cheating as we've known it. It's a cottage industry of cheating.
For those who didn't know, I looked it up. It was between $800 to $1,000, you get a guarantee A.
Yep.
It was a very known thing. Students know where they are. You know, if you just go, you know what, I just need to get an ECA on this, you can do that. And they will do everything, including creating the presentation and giving you notes. If you should, you need to show up in person to make that presentation at the final day.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that's been available, right? And that's been one of the most common forms of plagiarism. So I'm just sharing this to say, I don't think AI created plagiarism or even exacerbated it. What it's done is complicate our understanding of it, because now there's an easier route. But we also know that when students are, you know, going back to belonging in inclusive classrooms, we also know that intrinsic motivation is a very, very powerful human thing, phenomenon. If a student is engaged in something that they're doing, if they have that interest in something that they're doing, they are more likely to do it even when shortcuts are available. So let's go back to video games as an example, because of course, there have been things like GameShark. Their AI has been part of the video game community and world for years, where it's very easy to program a bot to play the game for you, so you get the rewards from the game that you want, whether it's the digital currency of the game or whether it's outfits for your avatar or whether it's just, you know, to show up on a leaderboard and to brag to the world that you're the best Madden player or NBA 2K player. You can actually program a bot to do the video game playing for you. Now, there hasn't been a lot of formal research into this use, But I have to believe that the video game industry would collapse if people weren't actually playing the games anymore, right? So here comes this mode for you to cheat the thing that you love doing, and people don't use it or at least abuse it too much, right? They might, even if it's incorporated, they're still playing the game, they're still involved in the community, they're still doing the thing that they're being asked to do by these game developers. The involvement's still there, the engagement's still there. The stakes are a lot lower. They don't even have to win. They're just doing it for their own personal satisfaction. So they're more likely to actually do it and go into the flow, right? And be engaged in that moment. And I think we can treat education the same way, right? So when I'm working with my class, you know, when you talked about project-based learning, I break everything down into these separate parts. I'm doing my best to lower the stakes, you know, because I want students to make mistakes. I want them to fail so they can learn from failure, not fail and then have that F follow them around the rest of their life. And when I do those things, at least in my own class surveys and my own, you know, research, my own action research, students are less likely to take a shortcut regardless of what it is. Even if it's ChatGPT, I ran a study last semester. And because of the choices that they're making, because they say things like, this topic's really important to me, or they might say things like, the way the assignment is broken up, it's actually more work for me to use AI. It's easier for me to just do the work because you've broken it out into chunks for me where I feel I have the capability to complete this assignment. Well, now we're not talking about plagiarism anymore. We're talking about motivation. And I'd rather have the discussion go there, where, like, let's talk about how AI can help motivate. With that in mind and thinking about equity, imagine a student. So I teach writing classes. Imagine a student who uses English as a second or third language. It's not their home language. It's not the language they use when they talk to their family members, or even when they think to themselves. It's not the language that they use. And I ask the student to write an essay just like I ask all my other students to write an essay. Right from the beginning, this student is not at the same starting point as everyone else. So now there's an issue of equity. Let's say that student uses ChatGPT to draft an outline or even an introductory paragraph with the goal of, I'm going to try my best to make the rest of my writing look like that introductory paragraph. I can look at that as plagiarism, or I can look at that as leveling the playing field, right? That now that student has an equal starting point as everybody else. And so for me, it's more about motivation and equity, because plagiarism is a much longer an issue that we've had to face for many more years. And I think it has more to do with how engaged and involved students are than what tools are available.
I think it really goes into that just in time and just in case area too. Like for me, you know, like when you go in and play Legend of Zelda, if someone were to say, hey, let me play it for you, you'd be like, no way.
Exactly.
I want to get to play this. That's the whole point. But I think that there is this, I've been using this other, I'm going to throw this analogy to you and see what you think of it. Because I think people go, well, you know, Legend of Zelda is fun. So it's entertainment. How can you compare that to, you know, the textbook? Okay, fine, whatever. I'm going to give you a slightly different analogy here, because video game is so fun that they're like, you know, oh, sure, I can binge watch, you know, Netflix for like 11 hours straight because they're high production value, et cetera, et cetera. Sure. All right. So let's take a musician or an athlete. Let's take an athlete that has to train to run a marathon. Now, by the way, they do cheat in different ways, you know, yep, performance and enhancing drugs, you know, things like that. But if they were to be told, let's say you are someone who wants to run a marathon, you are not an experienced runner, you ran online, bought a course or read a book, they gave you, I mean, this, by the way, really does exist. They give you these courses that basically said you have, you know, 4 months or 6 months, you know, in every single week, they tell you how many miles you should run and for how long and how fast, so that they peak you all the way to like the week before, you know, you run the marathon, you'll be able to log about, you know, you can actually run 20-ish miles that week, and then the adrenaline will push you through to the 26 and finish, right? So people just want to finish, right? And I'm not talking about ultra competitor here, just someone who said, hey, it's always been my bucket list, me really run a marathon, right? And you can talk to the person, they go to week 3, they're supposed to, I don't know, run, you know, like log, 8 miles that week, maybe 4 times 2 miles a piece. All right. You could not pay that person to have someone else run for them.
Exactly.
By the way, these are hard. Right? By the time you get to the 13th week, they might be running 18 miles that week. And they're running, you know, 6 miles a pop. It's taking them a lot of time, energy, and it's not the, you know, it's not Legend of Zelda. It's like they are sweating, their head is telling them to stop, please stop.
You have cramps.
Working, yeah. Your joints not working. you are hungry, you know, all of that, right? So you're fighting extreme physical and mental discomfort and challenge to push yourself to be able to do it. Again, you couldn't pay this person to not do that.
100%.
Because they know that if they don't do it, they can't run that marathon, right? And that's what the thing they want the most. So there is, to me, this sort of, by the way, these are not people that knew, like they just somehow had this trust that this curriculum worked for them.
Yep.
Don't they? Right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
They didn't, students that come to many classes, not your class, because you are very good at getting them to understand that. But if without that, there is this huge misalignment, this huge gap that sets, look, I don't know why I'm doing this. So what does it matter if I had someone else do it? Because there is this huge misalignment on this doesn't matter to me, right? The stuff that actually does matter to you, like if you are that nurse and you're like, oh no, I really need to learn how to perform this task, because if I don't, I won't know what to do when the patient comes in and has this condition. So yep. I need to do it. I can't have someone else help me do it. Like maybe I can, so to speak, cheat by saying, well, you thought I need to have it done, like pat down now, but I don't yet. I need a little cheat sheet, so to speak. Fine, right? But actually, I want to do it. I want to learn it. So I think that's that trust and that misalignment that is really like powering a lot of this. And the gap gets wedged and wedged wider and wider and wider to the point where a student just kind of go, yeah, I can just pay, like forget the AI part. I can pay $800 and get a guaranteed A.
Yep.
Any school.
Yep.
Why don't I just do that?
Exactly. I mean, you're describing motivation theory perfectly, right? It's all about goal setting, and those goals have to be distal and proximal, right? So the distal goal of I want to be able to run a marathon or just complete a marathon, that's a distal goal. I know that I can't do that tomorrow. I can't even do that in a year necessarily. I need lots of training. What's going to keep me motivated and keep me on track, you know, through the curriculum are those proximal goals, goals that are close enough to be achievable. And when I achieve them, I can publicly celebrate them, and I can, and that motivates me and encourages me to move on to the next goal. Those goals have to always be in range, right? So I think about Vygotsky's zone of proximal development, right? We need to constantly set goals that are just outside of our threshold, but they look like they're just in arm's reach, right? Like I'm almost there, right? I can do 4 miles this week, right? I've done two. I just need two more and I'm right there. And then before I know it, it's 13 miles, right? Because that goal became within my threshold, fell within my threshold. And that's how we need to set up a curriculum, right? And so, for example, I'm a large advocate, and we're doing this in much larger areas now here at Quinnipiac. You know, we tend to, the traditional story is we cap a course with its climax, to use this a story metaphor, with the final exam, which is high stress, high stakes, and largely disconnected from us. We just do a multiple choice test. Many students do, right? Or they do their 20-page research paper. Even if they're invested in it, you know, it might just be by the end of 20 pages of writing this, I'm done and I never want to see this topic again, right? We're not at a good place when we reach final exam week. We bring puppies on the campus to help de-stress people because of how much we stress them out for final exam. So yeah. What we're doing now is we're calling it a showcase week, right? So by the time the final exam week comes, at least for the College of Arts and Science, which is going to run this huge showcase this year, instead of asking students to take a test or to submit this major onerous product, we're going to hold space where they can engage with authentic audiences. You know, we're going to invite employers, we're going to invite community members, and students are going to present to them, here's what I did this semester. Here's this work that I'm really proud of. It is literally and emphatically a showcase. Let's celebrate what you've accomplished. That needs to work in throughout the semester as well. I'm constantly trying to work in through my syllabus scheduled moments of public success. I want to set it up where the student cannot fail, no matter what. They will succeed these. And so they're not truly assessments. They're more of just a public showcase to prove to yourself that you can do it. You've accomplished this proximal goal. Now let's move on to the next one. Without that, we don't know what story we're telling, right? Like if I'm in a course and I don't see that relevance of that course, I'm not going to do what the marathon runner does, right? Because I don't see the goals and I don't see myself chasing those goals.
I think that's really a great it's a great way to see a solution, like what you were saying, this showcase at the end, right? It's such a meaningful solution that anyone can implement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just a change of the story that we tell about learning. Like, does it have to end with something as dreadful as a final exam?
I like the idea, or I like how you describe that. When you are at the end of this project, if you are supposed to, at the end, I go, I would never do this again. We've like literally just failed them, right?
Exactly.
Like that's different from like a musician that goes, by the time I've figured out how to, I can play this music, play this song, I want to keep doing it. This is when I get to perform.
Exactly.
This is not when I go, oh, thank God, I can like move on. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and that's my big pie in the sky dream is that courses will embrace edutainment, right? Like I don't think there should be a divide. And I know a lot of people will disagree with it, and that's fine. I'm always happy to have that conversation, but I do think education should be entertaining. I think entertainment is a fundamental human capacity. And maybe not even human. I think all species in some way, shape, or form are driven by the pleasure and joy of feeling good about being in a moment. And entertainment should be an instructional strategy. We shouldn't do what we can to leave it at the door.
Right. Like you come to school, no joy for you. Like, joy is not in the word school. So.
Right. Or even the word discipline. Right. Like, I mean, what discipline are you studying? I mean, that word itself, like discipline and punishment. to echo Foucault.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. I agree with you. I think that sort of this, you know, there isn't, I think it's a silly correlation that, you know, in order for you to succeed, you're going to put in some hard work as an unenjoyable work.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that should always be true. You know, sometimes we do them, like I was saying about the you know, the marathon runner, you sustain through, you know, sort of like serious challenges. But it doesn't, you know, I actually think that for many people that talk about that, there is joy to be had.
Mm-hmm.
in those instances, right? And people talk about their runner's high, but I think there is at least at the very minimum that sense of, you know, like, yes, I'm going to go through this. And at the end, it's going to have this, you know, like the feeling is going to be great when I finish like that 6 miles, you know, today.
Absolutely. Desirable difficulty.
Yeah. And I just think that, you know, in education, a friend of mine, Professor Jordy Getman from Bronx Community College. Do you know him, by the way?
No.
And you really get along with him. We always talk about like this is sometimes it's, you know, it's academic laziness. It's like we thought like we designed this. We know it's gonna work in our head. You know, we just. Are too lazy to even explain to them why this is the case, and we don't need to convince you. You have to do this for me, as if you are like my employees. I pay, except that it's completely not true. You are serving well. So whatever, you know, that power dynamic of grade and this high stake thing that you talked about, this grade, this, you know, this like if you don't do this, you know, you're not going to get a grade. If you don't get a grade, you're going to get a certificate. Then your whole life is going to get ruined, right? And you're not going to get a job. You're not going to mm-hmm. be qualified to do this. And this, you know, creates a lot of some animosity almost, you know, between you know, the person who sets out to want to learn. That's why they even bothered applying to a school and getting in. And, you know, it's a lot of effort to get there. And then the person who actually took a job, took a profession, make their career. Many, many faculty members, you know, are, you know, it's something that hopefully that they enjoy, you know, teaching. And then there's a, some version of a passion in their head at some point, at least. But there is that little gap that is just stopping us from making that big, that connection. And I think for folks like you who can make that connection easily with the students, because you have a lot of empathy for them, because you can easily put yourself back into that mode of Legend of Zelda or this, and you have to be with Legend of Zelda in your own head constantly. Right, because if you can do that, then yeah, the students are gonna stay.
Yep. I mean, I think about course design as an epic story, right? Like, it's the hero's journey, in some way. We're like, at the start of every semester, every student is a hero going on their epic quest, and I just want them to realize that. And what is that elixir, right, that they're gonna bring back to that ordinary world? What is the thing that they are learning that they're gonna bring back to their world and improve their world because of becoming this hero?
Well, that's fantastic. JT, I think I can talk to you for a really long time, and maybe we should talk more.
I'm always happy, you know, to talk to you. Yeah, thank you.
But this is fantastic. I really, really appreciate you, you know, bringing it to this podcast. I love the way you think. I feel like we're really just scratching the surface. There's so much that you've done. By the way, did do some, you know, research. Usually don't even do a lot of research, but I did, you know, I actually started reading some of the stuff that you did, and your books.
You co-wrote
a book with another education scholar.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Jill Flanders Crosby. Yeah,
from University of Alaska, on dance.
Mm-hmm.
And your own novel, about Cuba, is that correct?
Yep. It's about a family. Uh-huh. I mean, it's auto fiction, right? So like, it's based on elements of my life, but just like a family trying to find their identity after they are forced to give up the identity that they had in Cuba. So it's a migration story about just being
so
in Florida.
You've done so much, and then you have articles about artificial intelligence. So I'm gonna try to make sure some of these things get put into the show notes so people can go look for your work. But we really need to get you back on so that we can discuss more of these topics, especially how quickly AI is going to continue to change the world and higher education. And I think there'll be a lot to be discussed here.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. It's at least job security, because AI is going to change so much that we need scholars to keep studying it.
Right. That's right. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, JT.
Thank you, Jeff.
I appreciate everything again. And we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
You too.
Coming up next, we'll be chatting with Andre Perez, a student at the University of Laverne. Here's a quick preview.
Be happy to share it too. Just be able to share it and just share it with anyone. Just focus on having fun. That's the most important part. And then also the grade helps too. Be serious, but also have fun with it. It's that perfect balance you just got to find. But don't try and just make it all academic. Try and put your own spin on it, because that's what a portfolio is all about.